Part 2. The Serapis. Chapter 14. October 14, 1991. Washington, D.C. A cold, bleak drizzle shrouded the nation's capital as a taxi pulled to a stop at 17th and Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the old executive office building. A man dressed in a deliveryman's uniform stepped from the rear seat and told the driver to wait. He leaned back in the taxi and retrieved a package wrapped in red silk. He hurried across the sidewalk and down several steps, passing through a doorway into the reception area of the mailroom. "For the president," he said with a Spanish accent. A postal service employee signed in the package and the time. He looked up and smiled. "Still raining?"
"More like a fine spray."
"Just enough to make life miserable." "And slow traffic," the deliveryman said with a sour face. "Have a good day anyway."
"You too."
The deliveryman left as the postal worker took the package and ran it under the fluoroscope. He stood back and stared at the screen as the X-rays revealed the object under the wrapping. He easily identified it as a briefcase, but the picture puzzled him. There was no indication of files or papers inside. No hard object with a distinguishing outline. Nothing that looked like explosives. He was an old hand at X-ray identification, but the contents of the case threw him. He picked up the phone and made a request to the person on the other end. Less than 2 minutes later, a security agent appeared with a dog.
"Got one for Sweet Pea?" asked the agent.
The postal worker nodded as he set the package on the floor.
"Can't make an ID on the scope."
Sweet Pea hardly resembled her namesake. She was a mutt, the result of a brief affair between a beagle and a dachshund. Huge brown eyes, a fat little body supported by short spindly legs, Sweet Pea was highly trained to sniff out every explosive from the common to the exotic. As the two men watched, she waddled around the package, nose quivering like a plump dowager sniffing at a perfume counter. Suddenly she stiffened. The hair on her neck and back stood up, and she began backing away. Her face took on an odd, suspicious kind of distasteful expression, and she began to growl. The agent looked surprised.
"That's not her usual reaction."
"There's something weird in there," said the postal worker.
"Who is the package addressed to?"
"The president." The agent walked over and punched a number on the phone.
"We better get Jim Gerhardt down here."
Gerhardt, special agent in charge of physical security for the White House, took the call during a brief lunch at his desk and left immediately for the mail reception room. He observed the dog's reaction and eyeballed the package under the fluoroscope.
"I don't detect any wiring or detonation device," he said in a Georgia drawl.
"Not a bomb," the postal worker agreed.
"Okay, let's open it."
The red silk wrapper was carefully removed, revealing a black leather attaché case. There were no markings, not even a manufacturer's name or model number. Instead of a combination lock, both latches had inserts for a key. Gerhardt tried the latches simultaneously. They both unsnapped.
"The moment of truth," he said with a cautious grin.
He placed his hands on each corner of the upper lid and slowly lifted until the case was open and the contents in view.
"Jesus," Gerhardt gasped.
The security agent's face went white and he turned away. The postal worker made gagging noises and staggered for the lavatory. Gerhardt slammed the lid shut. "Get this thing over to George Washington University Hospital." The security agent couldn't reply until he swallowed the acid-tasting bile that had risen in his throat. Finally, he coughed.
"Is that thing real, or is this some kind of Halloween trick-or-treat?"
"It's genuine," said Gerhardt grimly, "and believe you me, it ain't no treat." In his White House office, Dale Nichols settled back in his swivel chair and adjusted his reading glasses. For perhaps the 10th time, he began scrutinizing the contents of a thick folder routed to him by Armando Lopez, the president's senior director of Latin American affairs. Nichols gave off the image of a university professor, which indeed he had been when the president persuaded him to switch his sedate campus classroom at Stanford for the political cesspool of Washington. His initial reluctance had turned to amazement when he discovered he had a hidden talent for manipulating the White House bureaucracy. His thicket of coffee-brown hair was parted neatly down the middle. His old-style spectacles, with small round lenses and thin wire frames, reflected a plodding temperament, a never-say-die type who was oblivious to everything but his immediate project.
And finally, the ultimate in academic clichés, the bow tie and the pipe. He lit the pipe without removing his eyes from the articles clipped from Mexican newspapers and magazines dealing with only one subject, Topiltzin. Included were interviews granted by the charismatic Messiah to officials who represented Central and South American countries. But he had refused to talk to American journalists or government representatives, and none had penetrated his army of bodyguards. Nichols had learned Spanish during a 2-year tour in Peru for the Peace Corps, and easily read the stories. He took a legal pad and began making a list of claims and statements that came to light during the interviews. 1. Topiltzin describes himself as a man who came from the poorest of the poor, born in a cardboard shack on the edge of Mexico City's sprawling garbage dump, with no idea of the day, month, or year. Somehow he survived and learned what it was to live amid the stink and flies and manure and muck of the hungry and homeless. 2. Admits to no schooling. History from childhood, until his emergence as a self-styled high priest of archaic Toltec-Aztec religion, is blank. 3. Claims to be the reincarnation of Topiltzin, 10th century ruler of the Toltecs, who was identified with the legendary god Quetzalcoatl. 4. Political philosophy, a crazy blend of ancient culture and religion, with vague sort of autocratic one-man, no-party rule. Intends to play benevolent father role to Mexican people. Ignores questions on how he intends to revive shattered economy. Refuses to discuss how he will restructure government if he comes to power. 5. Spellbinding orator. Has uncanny rapport with his audience. Speaks only in old Aztec tongue through interpreters, language still used by many Indians of central Mexico. 6. Mainstream supporters are fanatical. His popularity has swept the country like the proverbial tidal wave. Political analysts predict he could win a national election by nearly 6 percentage points. Yet he refuses to participate in free elections, claiming, and rightly so, that corrupt leaders would never surrender the government after a losing campaign. Topiltzin expects to take over the country by public acclaim. Nichols set his pipe in an ashtray, stared at the ceiling thoughtfully for a few moments, and began writing again. Summary: Topiltzin is either incredibly ignorant or incredibly gifted. Ignorant if he is what he says he is. Gifted if he has a method to his madness, a goal only he can see. Trouble, trouble, trouble. Nichols was going over the articles again, searching for a key to Topiltzin's character, when his phone buzzed. He picked up the receiver. "The president on one," announced his secretary. Nichols punched the button. "Yes, Mr. President." "Any news of Guy Rivas?" "No, nothing." There was a pause on the president's end. Then, finally, "He was scheduled to meet with me 2 hours ago. I'm concerned. If he encountered a problem, his pilot should have sent us word by now." "He didn't fly to Mexico City in a White House jet," explained Nichols. "In the interests of secrecy, he booked passage on a commercial airliner and flew coach class as a tourist on vacation." "I understand," the president agreed. "If President De Lorenzo learned I sent a personal representative behind his back to make contact with his opposition, he'd take it as an insult and scratch our Arizona conference next week." "Our primary concern," Nichols assured him. "Have you been briefed on the UN charter crash?" the president asked, suddenly changing tack. "No, sir," replied Nichols. "My only information is that Hala Camille survived. She and 2 crew members. The rest died from poison." "Poison?" Nichols blurted incredulously. "That's the word from the investigators. They believe the pilot tried to poison everyone on board before parachuting from the plane over Iceland." "The pilot must have been an imposter." "We won't know till a body is found, warm or cold." "Christ, what terrorist movement would have a motive for murdering over 50 UN representatives?" "So far, none have claimed credit for the disaster. According to Martin Brogan at CIA, if it is the work of terrorists, they stepped out of character on this one." "Hala Camille might have been the target," suggested Nichols. "Ahmad Yazid has sworn to eliminate her." "We can't ignore the possibility," the president admitted. "Have the news media gotten wind of it?" "The story will be all over the papers and TV in the next hour. I saw no reason to hold it back." Is there anything you'd like me to do, Mr. President? I'd appreciate it, Dale, if you'd monitor reaction from President DeLorenzo's people. There were 11 delegates and agency representatives from Mexico on the flight. Offer condolences in my name and any cooperation within limits. Oh, yes, you'd better keep Julia Schiller over at the State Department informed so we don't stumble over each other. I'll get my staff right on it. And let me know the minute you hear from Rivas. Yes, Mr. President. Nichols hung up and forced his attention back to the file. He began to wonder if Topiltzin was somehow connected with the UN murder. If only there was a thread he could grasp. Nichols was not a detective. He had no talent for coldly dissecting a prime suspect layer by layer until he knew what made the man tick. His academic specialty was in systems projections of international political movements. Topiltzin was an enigma to him. Hitler had a misguided vision of Aryan supremacy. Driven by religious fervor, Khomeini wanted to return the Middle East to the Muslim fundamentals of the Dark Ages. Lenin preached a crusade of world communism. What was Topiltzin's objective? A Mexico of the Aztecs? A return to the past? No modern society could function under such archaic rules. Mexico was not a nation to be run on the fantasies of a Don Quixote. There had to be another driving force behind the man. Nichols was conjecturing in a vacuum. He glimpsed Topiltzin only as a caricature, a villain in a cartoon series. His secretary entered unannounced and laid a file folder on his desk. The report you asked for from the CIA, and you have a call on line 3. Who is it? A James Gerhardt, she replied. White House security, said Nichols. Did he say what he wanted? Only that it was urgent. Nichols became curious. He answered the call. This is Dale Nichols. Jim Gerhardt, sir, in charge of... Yes, I know, Nichols interrupted. What's the problem? I think you better come down to the pathology lab at George Washington. The University Hospital? Yes, sir. What in hell for? I'd rather not say too much over the phone. I'm very busy, Mr. Gerhardt. You'll have to be more specific. There was a short silence. This is a matter concerning you and the President. That's all I can say. Can't you at least give me a clue? Gerhardt ignored the probe. One of my men is waiting outside your office. He will drive you to the lab. I'll meet you in the waiting room. Listen to me, Gerhardt. That was as far as Nichols got when the snarl of the dial tone struck his ear. The drizzle had turned to rain, and Nichols's disposition mirrored the dismal weather as he was led through the University Hospital's entrance to the pathology laboratory. He hated the ether-like smells that permeated the halls. True to his word, Gerhardt waited in the anteroom. The two men knew each other by sight and name, but had never spoken. Gerhardt came forward, but made no effort to shake hands. "Thank you for coming," he said in an official tone. "Why am I here?" Nichols asked directly. "For an identification." Nichols was suddenly flooded with foreboding. "Who?" "I'd prefer you tell me." "I don't have the stomach for looking at dead bodies." "This isn't exactly a body, but you will need a strong stomach." Nichols shrugged. "All right, let's get it over with." Gerhardt held the door open and guided him down a long corridor and into a room with large white tiles inlaid on the walls and floor. The floor was slightly concave with a drain in its center. A stainless steel table stood in stark solitude in the middle of the room. A white, opaque plastic sheet covered a long object that rose no more than an inch above the surface of the table. Nichols looked at Gerhardt in bewilderment. "What am I supposed to identify?" Without a word, Gerhardt lifted the sheet and pulled it away, letting it drop in a crumpled wad on the floor. Nichols stared at the thing on the table, uncomprehending. At first he thought it was a paper outline of a man's figure. Then he shuddered as the gory truth struck him. He leaned over the floor drain and threw up. Gerhardt stepped from the room and quickly returned with a folding chair and a towel. He steered Nichols to the chair and passed him the towel. "Here," he said without sympathy, "use this." Nichols sat for nearly 2 minutes, clutching the towel against his face and dry retching. At last he recovered enough to look up at Gerhardt and stammer. "Good Lord, that's nothing but skin," Gerhardt finished for him. "Flayed human skin." Nichols forced himself to stare at the grisly thing stretched out on the table. He was reminded of a deflated balloon. That was the only way he could describe it. An incision had been made from the back of the head down to the ankles, and the skin peeled away from the body like a pelt from an animal. There was a long vertical slit in the chest that had been crudely sewn. The eyes were missing, but the entire dermis was there, including both shriveled hands and feet. "Can you tell me who you think he might be?" asked Gerhardt softly. Nichols made a conscious effort, but the grotesque, misshapen facial features made it all but impossible. Only the hair seemed vaguely familiar. Yet he knew. "Guy Rivas," he murmured. Gerhardt said nothing. He took Nichols by the arm and helped him to another room that was comfortably furnished with soft chairs and a coffee urn. He poured a cup of coffee and handed it to Nichols. "Drink this. I'll be back in a minute." Nichols sat there as if in a nightmare, shocked by the sickening sight in the other room. He could not bring himself to grips with the reality of Rivas's horrible death. Gerhardt came back carrying an attaché case. He set it on a low table. "This was dropped off at the male reception room. The body skin was tightly folded inside. At first I thought it was the work of some psycho. Then I made a thorough search and found a miniature tape recorder mounted beneath the interior lining." "You played it?" "A lot of good it did. Sounds like a conversation between two men and some kind of code." "How did you trace Rivas to me?" "Rivas's government ID card had been placed inside his flayed skin. Whoever murdered him wanted to make sure we'd put a make on the remains. I went to Rivas's office and interrogated his secretary. I wormed it out of her that he met with you and the president for 2 hours before leaving for the airport and a flight to an unknown destination. I thought it unusual that his own secretary didn't know his destination, so I reckoned he'd been sent on a classified mission. That's why I contacted you first." Nichols looked at him narrowly. "You say there's a conversation on the tape?" Gerhardt nodded gravely. "That, and Rivas's screams as he was cut apart." Nichols closed his eyes, trying to force the vision from his mind. "His next of kin will have to be notified," Gerhardt continued. "He have a wife?" "And 4 kids. "You know him well?" "Guy Rivas was a nice man, one of the few people with integrity I've met since coming to Washington. We worked together on several diplomatic missions." For the first time, Gerhardt's stony face went soft. "I'm sorry." Nichols didn't hear him. His eyes slowly turned bitter and cold. The nightmare-like expression had gone. He no longer tasted the vomit or felt sickened by the horror. The brutal savagery inflicted on someone close to him had triggered a floodgate of anger, anger such as Nichols had never known before. The professor, whose scope of power was limited to the walls of a classroom, no longer existed. In his place was a man close to the president, one of a small elite group of Washington power brokers with the muscle to shape events or create havoc around the globe. By whatever means and power that were his in the White House, with or without presidential favor or official sanction, Nichols was set on avenging the murder of Rivas. Topiltzin had to die.